And another part of my research looks at language as a social phenomenon. So I'm interested in how different processes in the society, political processes, cultural processes, are reflected in language use. Okay. And also what language can tell us about individual language users. So it's a combination of both. My work in the domain of formal properties of language is about different grammatical categories. So I've done some work on evidentiality. It's a grammatical category that expresses source of information in language. I also worked on grammatical case and the difference between verbs and nouns. My work on social aspects of language focuses on what language reveals about the society. So one of my more recent projects looks at what language tells us about the properties of individual speakers. And here I looked at word order. So for example, if you use Democrats and Republicans, what does it tell us about your political affiliation? Or if you use the opposite word order, like Republicans and Democrats, what's the implication? And the finding from this study is that people tend to use words that are psychologically closer to them first. So if you're a Democrat, you are more likely to say Democrats and Republicans. And if you're a Republican, you're more likely to use Republicans and Democrats.
Looking specifically at gender, we were curious about why some languages use gender pronouns and others don't. And
yes.
How does that come about?
That's an interesting question, and very often it's a consequence of how language develops, and it's a consequence of language typology. So if you look at the distribution of languages that encode, that have gender pronouns, I think that in a sample included in a World Atlas of Language Structures, it's a great resource for linguists and non-linguists alike. So in the sample that they studied, 70% of languages actually do not encode gender in their pronominal system. So languages that do encode gender in their pronominal system, like English, are actually the minority. So it's only 30% of languages. In terms of geographical distribution, languages that do encode gender in pronouns are primarily spoken in Africa, Europe, and northern parts of Australia. The cluster of languages that do not encode gender in their pronominal system are, I think, South Asian languages. So it's difficult to see what motivates it. So for me, this strategy, specific strategy, is mostly grammatical, and it depends on the properties of individual languages. Linguists distinguish between gender as part of pronominal system and gender as a system for classifying nouns. So in English, gender is encoded in pronouns, like so we have he and she. But nouns in English are genderless, right? So if you look at the distribution of grammatical gender in languages, it also seems that there are languages that do have grammatical gender and languages that do not have grammatical gender. So it's okay to have a language that doesn't have a grammatical gender. Now, English actually did have grammatical gender. In Old English, we had masculine, feminine, and neutral. We had three grammatical genders. But then it was lost by the time of the Middle English. So it happens. Languages can lose gender, and English actually is one of the examples. So if you compare it to other languages that have similar structure, like Germanic languages, so German has preserved the grammatical gender, but English has lost it. And there are other cases in which languages completely lose gender, so Armenian is one such language, and Persian is another example. In languages that have grammatical gender, gender is manifested in what we call agreement. If I use adjective beautiful, it would have to agree with the gender of the noun. So if I say beautiful day in Russian, beautiful will need to be masculine gender, because day is masculine gender. So there will be one ending on adjective. But if I use the same adjective, beautiful, to modify picture, if I say a beautiful picture, then because picture is feminine, beautiful in this context will need to be feminine as well. So there will be a different ending on the adjective. Yeah, so it's not neuter, it's just not present, not encoded in language. So especially in the case of he and she, in this case, gender is semantically based, right? So we usually use he to refer to males and she to refer to females. And it does feel like a fundamental feature of the language. But again, there are other languages that do not have this distinction. There is just one single pronoun, and it can be used in reference to males and to females. There is nothing inherently in the language that requires this distinction. But once we have it, it seems that it's really difficult to get rid of it. So the prescriptive rules in the 19th century, they advocated the use of he as a gender-neutral pronoun, right? But then the feminist movement in the 1970s really opposed this, and they viewed it as a manifestation and propagation of sexism in language. And gradually we got to the point where it's no longer okay to use he as a gender-neutral pronoun, and now many style manuals have actually adopted the usage of singular they as a gender-neutral pronoun. So in this case, it's definitely a reflection of what happens in the society. Oh, so actually I wanted to tell you more about part of my research on gender. It goes back to the project on word order. One example that I gave was with Republicans and Democrats. But as part of this study, my co-author and I also looked at gender words, so word order in gender words, like men and women. And it's interesting that as with pronouns, there were prescriptive rules that required the usage of male referent first in the 16th and 17th century. So it applied not only to common nouns like the king and the queen, but also to names. So that's why we have Romeo and Juliet, not Juliet and Romeo, and Anthony and Cleopatra, not the other way around. So these are consequences of these prescriptive rules from the 16th and 17th century. If you look at the distribution of gender words in contemporary English, indeed what we find is that male first words in pairs like men and women or boy and girl are more frequent. So male gender is mentioned first. But what is interesting is that this is starting to change. So if you look at the ratio of men and women and compare it to the ratio of women and men, so you see that there are very interesting processes. What happened is that in the beginning of the century, the ratio of female first words was 1 to 60. So men and women is a dominant, is definitely a more frequent word order. And then it peaked around the time of the First and Second World Wars. The ratio during that time was 1 to 90. So men and women was much more frequent than women and men. But if you look at the graph and here around 1970s, you see that it starts to change. So again, and it coincides with the feminist movement in the 1970s. So by the end of the century, the ratio of women and men to men and women is actually 1 to 5. So it's another example of how language reflects processes in the society.
There was a boy in our town with long hair. I mean, really long hair. And everybody pointed at him and laughed at him and made fun of him. And when he walked down the street, the people would roar and stick their tongues out and make funny faces and run in and slam their door and shout at him from the window until he couldn't stand it anymore. So he sat down and cried till his whole body shook. And pretty soon his hair shook too, and it flapped and flapped, and he lifted and flew.
I have flown to star-stained heights on bent and battered wings, in search of mythical kings, mythical kings.
Five Unexpected Gender Differences in Children's Clothing by Catherine D.M. Clover. Difference number five, the quality of the fabric often differs. Other parents warned me about this one, and I just did not believe them. But let me tell you something, the boys' stuff is of higher quality. The fabrics are thicker, sturdier, and longer wearing. The clothing is less flimsy, it's also just plain warmer. Shopping for my son on the cusp of winter last year inspired my mother-in-law to say, "Don't little girls get cold?" I'm sure they must, and when they do, their parents have an option of handing them a thin, useless cardigan or braving the boys' section for an actual sweater.
Hi, my name is Ali Quintos. I'm turning 40 this year, and I live in San Francisco in a beautiful, big, extended family household. Lots of people of different generations and animals. And for money, I'm a birth doula, childbirth educator, and educational consultant. I work mostly with nonprofits here in San Francisco.
Hello, I'm Manuel Quintos. I go to SF Community School. I'm 8 years old. I like to create engineering projects.
So you got the email from your school saying that we were doing this radio program, and what inspired you to respond and want to talk to us?
Well, what inspired me was kind of my cousin, Robbie. I heard you were doing like a project on interviewing me about how I feel about my gender, right? So my cousin Robbie is actually transgender, so, and I just had a visit to her. Well, he turned into her like a week ago in Beverly, Massachusetts, so that's just what inspired me to do.
I think that living in the Bay Area gives us a great opportunity for the kids to have friends and their parents' friends, and also their friends' parents, who are of all different gender expressions. Really, from birth, some of his best friends had trans parents, and we were always really open about it whenever the kids had questions about it, right? About biology, about, you know, anatomy or gender expression, how people dress, we would just kind of follow their lead. I don't think we had a particular agenda, just answering questions when they came up. I think both of our kids to the outside world present as sometimes differently gendered than how they feel. And so that also brings up a lot of questions about, you know, how to answer, sort of code switching, when it makes sense to get into a long conversation about it, when it's just okay to smile and let it roll. For Manuel, he's had long hair since he was about 4 and a half.
I don't think it's strange at all that people ask that. I'm just like, I'm a boy, I just chose to have long hair. I feel like a boy.
For us, the labels of gender, both my partner and I, in our internal landscape, feel pretty fluid. Both of us present very cisgendered, and that's fine with us. So if people straight up ask us, you know, are you a woman and a man, we say yes. But I think, especially with our kids, they're so unique and their personalities are ever-changing. And, you know, they're just them. So with their gender, I don't think it bothers us too much when people ask.
They're practicing their splits.
You know, mostly we just let them answer for themselves. And if they are feeling shy, then we whisper in their ear, like, you don't have to talk to that person. You know, giving them an out.
I like to choose tight-fitting clothes because I'm a lot of an acrobat and a gymnast.
Mm-hmm.
I take aerial classes, so I don't honestly care that much about my clothes, except for sometimes that if it's like too girly or too boyish, like that I don't like. I just like arrows. This could be boy tights or girl tights. Like, this could be a boy or a girl wearing it. I like clothes that don't represent one single gender or the other.
Is it hard to find those kinds of clothes? Or is it...
No, it's not hard at all.
When he was a baby, sometimes we would get bags of hand-me-downs, and there would be really, really gendered, like, slogans, even on baby onesies. I used to just sew patches on them. You know, I would get, like, I don't know, a cute seahorse patch and sew it over top of the thing that said, I'm a tough little boy, or something like that on a baby onesie. So that's how we got around all that.
Sometimes, for Naida, for instance, some of the, like, the most exaggerated ones, we just turn them into rags, straight up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, Daddy's Little Princess, or, you know, Look How Cute I Am, or something like that.
Naida is going to start kindergarten in August.
I went to the same preschool as her, so I know all of her friends and stuff like that, but she's going to go to my school in August, since it's a K-8 school, so I'm very happy.
Yeah, they're pretty close. They do a lot of block constructing. We've accumulated over the years lots of random collections of old blocks. And
lots of dragons.
Lots of plastic dragons. And they're pretty into board games. Uh-huh. So we play a lot of, like, card games, dominoes.
I really also like engineering, like, things that you can tinker with. So Legos are top choice. I love, like, games that you can, like, act in, like soccer. And I used to take soccer, but now I don't. Now I take modern dance and I take aerial, which are my two, like, hobbies. I want to concentrate. I want to be an aerialist engineer.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite superhero?
Legolas.
Legolas? Okay.
For a few months, he was dedicated with building wooden weapons and decorating them with, you know, elf symbols.
For when he just gets dressed up, he often likes us to put his hair in, like, a
braids.
Braid.
Yeah. Like, for weddings and fancy events.
Like Legolas,
yeah. Otherwise, he wears his hair down, but for fancy events, he likes it in braids.
So one time I was at school, and then I went to winter break, and we were at my mom's really close cousin, Matt's wedding with another person called Hannah. And then I decided to paint my nails red for the wedding, and then And then once I got back, I decided to take them to school. But then there was this guy called Daniel that thought that was strange, so he called me a few names. But then I didn't mind that much. I was just like, okay, yeah, and? And then Mr. Sanchez, one of the behavior support instructors and the tech teacher, got a talk for the whole class, and then everyone talked about it, and they realized that it was okay. But now I feel different. I feel like half boy, half myself, sort of. I actually feel kind of more fluid than boy, but...
And there have been other moments where he's felt less boy and more in the middle, and we just check in with him and ask what he needs, like if he wants us to tell anyone about it, and he's always said no, that he just wants it to be a private thing, and to the world he continues to just be Manuel. So we respect that and just let him know that, you know, we're here to support him if he ever needs help describing it to the world, but that's totally not something that there's any pressure to do. Same with Naida. I think we've really learned they don't necessarily always need us to step in and correct people or say things or protect them in that way. I guess they feel at this moment really confident in who they are, and saying you're a boy or you're a girl to Manuel, I don't think that they take it as an insult in any way. like, being a girl is not a bad thing, so...
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that, Lana?
Yeah, that I just don't mind.
Very rarely do you ever correct anybody if they assume...
Yeah, only, like, at formal occasions.
Yeah, but just in general, in passing on the street, if we're in a store and somebody says... Oh, you know, people always comment on my mom's hair. They'll say, she has beautiful hair. He mostly just says, thank you. You know, it's like, there's no real need to correct people when you're in the checkout line.
It definitely feels like that people's understanding of their gender says a lot more about their own relationship to gender than anything that the kids have to feel about
yeah.
it.
But I think that's what we were saying is what has been interesting lately is people who we would define as in the radical queer community, and then if they speak in a way that gets their gender wrong about the kids, they feel really terrible and kind of keep apologizing about it. And, you know, and we were talking about it, and it probably has a lot to do with their own experience of growing up and having other people's projections on them. I think it's also very generational and, like, where you're living. So these guys are growing up in an environment that's pretty supportive of their gender fluidity, and I don't think at this moment in time they have a lot of baggage around it. People of our generation probably do, because the way that we were raised was really, really different. I think it's just interesting, like, observing that dynamic a lot of times between adult projections and then how they react to it.
It's kind of really inspirational to see the kids just like, no, I don't want to go that way, you know, all one way or the other. That's really been the learning curve for me, where I've been able to learn from my kids about, like, not necessarily needing to bow down to the pressures from, especially from older generations.
You know, when we were staying with my cousin last weekend in Massachusetts, that was a topic that came up for us a lot around language and how, you know, both Eric and I and my cousin and her partner, you know, we feel very supportive of this child's decision, you know, to express their gender differently and want to really support and protect in whatever way we can. But the shifting of pronouns and not using gendered language, how it's such a stretch for us. It's like, whoa, reprogramming the brain. And I don't know, the older we get, it feels hard. I mean, we're going to keep working at it. But then just observing, like, between the cousins, for them, it was so easy to not use gendered language. And they just called Robbie Robbie and said, pass me Robbie's book. Hey, Robbie, can I see your dinosaur?
And also, yeah. That they didn't care when Robbie used the different genders to refer to.
Yeah, like pretty much the whole, you know, the whole weekend we were staying with them, Robbie referred to Naida as he and Manuel as she, and none of them cared. Nobody corrected anybody. They would kind of, you know, Naida would sometimes use she pronouns for Robbie, and Manuel pretty much always just called Robbie, but mm-hmm. It was just so interesting watching, you know, as adults, that for us it's such a struggle and a real learning curve to reprogram our own use of language, just how easeful it seemed for them. A little while ago, when Manuel was asking a lot more questions or sharing more about just mm-hmm. gender fluidity, I did some research and found a group of parents that were meeting up here in our neighborhood, and there were also native Spanish speakers in the group, and I went to a few sessions and found it really, really helpful. It's humbling to not feel like I have a lot of vocabulary to talk about something that watching my kids live it seems so natural for them. And then realizing that there's just a big gap for me, not just in my vocabulary, but also resources like, you know, camps Manuel might want to go to later on.
Or,
yeah. And a lot of the parents in the group had older kids who had either fully transitioned or were very out about being genderqueer, like middle school age, high school age. I felt a huge sense of relief knowing that if my kids do continue to feel gender fluid, and if I feel like a fish out of water. I know where to go, or I know who to call. And I wonder about other families, even here in the Bay Area. I mean, you'd think in the middle of San Francisco, like, we would have all of that at our fingertips. But honestly, for me, I've been working in education for almost 2 decades, and I didn't really know. Just luckily, we met a mom who is in our community and is a educator and has a daughter who's trans, and very vocal about it. She's a very vocal advocate, especially amongst the Latino community. And it was just kind of serendipitous. Like, we met her, and all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, now I know, you know, now I know stuff, and I have websites to look at, and all these things that I didn't really know before.
I kind of felt that it was easier for me to refer to someone as just Robbie or not a he or a she. So I honestly found that kind of alleviating, because instead of referring as the always as the known he or she, I just preferred.
You felt relief?
Yeah, I felt relief, a lot, lots of relief.
I want to talk a little bit about my toys.
About your toys? Yeah, go for it.
Sure. I like to play with my toys, and I like my toys not princessy, because everyone has their own thing that they like. I don't like princesses. I like sporty things. I like football, ballet. And I also like to get in calm, like doing yoga.
Yeah, Naida's sort of always been a little yogi. She meditates a lot on her own. Especially our house can be really, really loud and chaotic a lot. So we'll find her in a corner just humming to herself. Naida really has a lot of identity with being sporty. It's sort of her identity right now. She just joined her first soccer team and is pretty into it.
I like playing with Lego sometimes. I like reading books with my dad. I like dancing and dance parties with my dad and my mom and my brother. And I also like doing cuddly and reading some books and then, like, eating some lunch and playing with some Legos after and reading some books again.
One of the last times that somebody asked Naida if she was a boy or a girl, she gave them a really funny look, and she just said, "No, silly, I'm a cat."
We would like to thank all the people who took time out of their busy lives to talk to us. Tasha, Scott, Skylar, and Thea Leverett, Rosario Villasana, Laura Lee Hind, Anastasia Smirnova, and Ali, Eric, Manuel, and Naida. Liu Cooper read A Short Story by David Escobar Galindo. Kate Godfrey read The Long-Haired Boy by Shel Silverstein. And Adina Goldstein read 5 Unexpected Differences in Children's Clothing by Catherine D.M. Clover. Special thanks to Isaac Master, music by Alan Silvestri, Concrete Blonde, Solo and Indre, Marianne Faithful, Bart Hopkin, Sun Ra, Dory Previn, and The Gits. We also want to give special thanks to Kate Raphael and the Women's Department of KPFA for allowing us to present this program. This program was produced by Mary Salome and Emily Charles of Queer in Your Ear Productions.